Division. We do have a quorum, as I indicated. So we're going to need a motion to approve the minutes. If we can get one from Mr. Representative Morrow over there.
So moved.
Any discussion? Hearing none, the motion is approved and the minutes are good to go. And we have some excellent testimony before us this morning that we're going to have a chance to review. And I see we have our first testifier before us right now. Mr. Fields, you want to identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the opportunity to be here. My name is Gary Fields. I'm the project consultant to the Glandon Foundation Broadband Initiative, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. The presentation I'm about to make is strictly informative. We have no legislation. There's no specific proposal. It's really just to give you some information about the efforts that we've undertaken and how we think it can be supportive in your activities. Again, my background is not in telecommunications. I've got about a 25-year history in economic development. My most recent engagement was the state of Minnesota. I was deputy commissioner of the Department of Trade and Economic Development for about 5 years. When I left there about 4 years ago, I started a consulting practice with foundations that put their invest in economic development and housing. And I had the opportunity to talk to the Blandon Foundation, who is very concerned about rural economies, and consequently we launched this broadband initiative about 4 years ago. I suspect most of you are familiar with the Blandon Foundation. We're Minnesota's largest rural philanthropy, about $400 million in assets. There's really three main prongs to our approach. Leadership development is probably how we're best known. There's been thousands of Minnesota leaders that have been through our leadership training program. We have a grant-making operation that probably provides about $20 million a year, and public policy and engagement. And this is one of the initiatives in our public policy efforts. The other primary one is in forest products. We started this initiative, like I say, about 4 years ago because we were very concerned about rural economies and realized that telecommunications is an essential ingredient in transforming rural economies from a natural resource base to a knowledge economy. And it's just absolutely critical to both the infrastructure and use of these technologies to that transformation. And we see evidence of just how essential that is every day. We started this in 2003. We are guided by an 18-person strategy board that includes both the public and private sector representatives. On the inside of this cover, you can see, you know, who those members are. We've had great input from our advisors, including members of the administration, the legislature, CEOs from internet service providers, and some business people, as well as some local public officials as well. Our goals are really pretty simple. We want to increase the use of these technologies. We want to increase the residential and business capacity, and we want to increase the investment in broadband. We think this is absolutely critical to the economic survival of not just rural Minnesota, but actually all of Minnesota. What we discovered after we launched this effort is that the issues are really the same in urban areas as well as in outside the metro area. The issues are essentially identical. This is important to the overall economy of Minnesota. What we've done in the last 4 years, a couple of major, accomplishments. We've published a community guide to broadband development, and quite frankly, it's targeted to people like yourself. It's out of print now, but it's actually on our website. It's relatively brief, but it gives you the basics of broadband and gives you some ideas of some of the things that you can do to really help accomplish these important goals. So I encourage you to take a look at it if you have time. It's a good overall guide for policy leaders. We've held annual policy conferences where we bring in different perspectives and try to look to see how we can help increase our use and deployment of broadband. About 3 years ago, we launched a program called Get Broadband. It's a local community-based program that shows the businesses, the schools, the hospitals, the governments, the general public, what you can do with broadband to make your life more productive and efficient. We've run this program in about 29 communities. The foundation put $250,000 into this effort. And actually, I want to thank the legislature because you matched that investment a couple of years ago. So you've put $250,000 in this effort. We've run this program now in 29 communities. And last year, about a year and a half ago, we created a statewide broadband vision, again, out of our strategy board. I'll talk about that in a minute. Let me just take a second and talk about how we're doing compared to the rest of the world. The U.S. is no longer a global leader in broadband. With all due respect to Al Gore, the U.S. did invent the Internet, but you'd never guess that from the way you see it deployed and used today. Minnesota compares well with other states, but it doesn't really matter. Our economic competitors are all global, and we don't compare very well in other states. Rural communities lack the metro communities in terms of how people use broadband. Fewer people in rural Minnesota use broadband, but in terms of the actual infrastructure, in many rural communities, the infrastructure is better than the metro area. It really varies from area to area. So you see a range of the service that's available, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. In general, the broadband speeds in other countries, our global competitors, are actually much faster, and in many cases, it's much cheaper than in the U.S. We are losing this global battle in terms of broadband deployment and utilization. But the good news is that it is improving in Minnesota. We do see investment. It's slow, but our global position is actually weak. This is an unreadable graph. There's another version of that inside the chart. But the red bar there is the U.S. And the U.S. right now ranks in the mid-teens in broadband penetration in terms of the number of people that actually use broadband. All those countries ahead of us use broadband more than us. And they're generally the Pacific Rim and Northern Europe. And Canada. Those are countries all ahead of us in terms of the number of people per 1,000 or per 100 that use broadband. We have, in total, more users, but in terms of percentage of our population, we actually are in the mid-teens now. We don't use it to the best effectiveness. And that, quite frankly, discourages investment. It's hard to get, you know, internet service providers to invest in faster and higher speed broadband if people don't use it. So these things go hand in hand. We've got to get people to use it more if we're going to be able to track the type of investment we need. There are some quite a few countries that have major fiber-to-the-home or fiber-to-the-premise initiatives. Sweden, Japan, Korea, Singapore, France, the Netherlands, Germany all have a lot of major fiber-to-the-premise projects underway or in use right now. What we call U.S. broadband, or the FCC definition of broadband, if I can step back for a second about definitions, the FCC defines broadband as 200 kilobits per second in one direction, generally coming in. And that's, quite frankly, by international standards, is laughable, because these other countries are not only are providing megabit level service, which is 1,000 kilobits, but in some cases they're providing gigabit service, which is 1,000 megabits. So a number of these countries now have service available that's over 1,000 times faster than what we have available in the U.S. So that's really, you know, a concern for a number of reasons. One is businesses aren't as competitive, people aren't as productive. But when you start to ask the question, what would I do with all that bandwidth, with all that speed, the companies that are developing the applications to use that speed are not in the U.S. because that's not where the market is to use these products. The economic development, the vitality that comes from creating the services that use that kind of bandwidth are going to be in other places. Just like when electricity was invented, the users of electricity didn't come in countries that didn't have electricity. They came from where that the electricity was available. So not only are we less productive, but we're losing out on an economic opportunity. And so it really should be a concern as we look at to see what we can do to prepare our economy for growth. About a year and a half ago, we created a vision, and I want to share that with you just for a second because I think it's really important. And that's to ensure a high quality of life and a globally competitive future for its citizens, businesses, and communities. Minnesota is committed to making the necessary investment to become a world leader in the universal deployment and use of ultra-high-speed next-generation broadband. Nice apple pie kind of statement, but it's powerful when we realize that this is a challenge that's going to take both the public and private sector working together. If you look at who we have to catch up to, it's all in countries where the public and private sector work together. And there's not you know, most of the interface between the public and private sector in this issue has been on the regulatory side. It hasn't been on the investment side. The federal government has invested some funds in this, but it's not been a lot, and it's only been a certain segment. So it's a major challenge for us, but it's something that we're going to have to do. Incidentally, that vision was endorsed by the governor as well as all the gubernatorial candidates this last election. A couple of years ago, the governor made a strong endorsement of this. Broadband is important to future economic development as electricity was some years ago. Now, the interesting thing about this statement is the governor made that presentation to our conference from China. He used a laptop very similar to what I have here today and a $50 webcam from his hotel room. That's the way that presentation was made with the broadband that was available in Hong Kong. Now, it wasn't the greatest high definition. It wasn't the greatest speed. You know, we wanted to be able to provide a higher quality one, but we wanted to demonstrate this is the basic technology every one of you could do from your homes. So it's the basic level there today. If we wanted what we could do with a higher quality broadband, what our other countries have, is the governor could have engaged in a high definition conference with other governors, you know, and had an exchange in front of us at the conference. We couldn't do that today. With the setup that we have, we would need a higher speed of broadband to be able to do that kind of thing. We also created some principles that go with the vision, and I want to encourage you to think about these because I think these principles are very good in guiding your efforts. I think when you look to see, when you get legislation, you get all kinds of ideas coming your way. I've watched that in the past. These are some good principles to actually use as a screen, and I encourage you to look at those. We talk about ubiquity, which is a fancy foundation name for everybody has it. We really have it. This is not just for certain people or people with a lot of money or just businesses. It's really something that everybody's going to need. They won't all get it right away, you know, because it's going to take time to build out to that capacity, but everybody does need it. It needs to be symmetric in that we need speed, this high speed in both directions. A lot of the broadband that we get now, almost exclusively, is higher speed coming in and very slow speed going out. But as we're looking now to produce more content from our homes, as people work more from their own homes, we need high speed going out. And most of the infrastructure today doesn't support that very well. So we need it to be symmetric. We need it to be affordable. As I said before, we pay more than other countries for a slower speed of broadband. So we have to look for ways to encourage making it more affordable. We need to have competition. Competition is good. It brings prices down. It improves the quality of service. So we need to look for ways to encourage competition. It needs to be world-class. We need world-class broadband, not FCC definition of broadband. We already have FCC definition of broadband. I mean, across the state of Minnesota now, we have that pretty much everywhere. There's some pockets where they might not have service, but I would guess over 90% of Minnesota has FCC type of broadband right now. So that's not enough. We need collaboration and partnership between the public and private sector, and I'll give you some examples of where there have been some great success stories, and every one of them, there is collaboration between the public and private sector. And we also talk about neutrality, because we're not wedded to any one technology. Right now, fiber to the premises, the hot technology is great, looks like it has unlimited capacity, maybe tomorrow will be something else, so you don't get locked into any one technology, but obviously when you invest in something, you get locked in, because that's the one you choose, but we're not promoting any one technology. Let me just say a couple words about our Get Broadband program, and again, we thank you for your support and collaboration with us in funding this. This is a community-based program. We rank, every community that's in this program runs a number of educational events for their schools, their businesses, healthcare organizations, the general public. They run tech fairs, classes, demonstrations, and they just demonstrate the different things you can do with basic broadband. Been pretty successful. We've had 29 communities in the program. I believe some of your communities are in the program. We've now completed, the program takes about a year. Now some communities have completed the program, and what we found is that the take rates or the subscription rates for broadband go way up. They increase at a much faster rate than what's naturally occurring in the economy. So we know we're getting results. We're not exactly certain how we're getting them because we see some interesting surveys, but we know that the usage rates go up significantly when we run this program. Let me take a step back and just talk about the broadband infrastructure because this is really the next step. We know that we need to increase our usage to make it attractive for investment, but we know we have a long way to go to get the type of broadband that's available in other countries right now. To get that, you know, 100 megabit level speed and that gigabit level speed, very few communities have it. surprisingly, the places that you see fiber to the home initiatives, there are about roughly 10 communities across the state that have it. They're all outside the metro area. There are about 10, 12 communities that have fiber to the home. Incredible bandwidth, is capable of incredible bandwidth. You know, it's much faster than what's available over your coax cable from your cable TV company, or your copper telephone lines from your telephone company, or the wireless service that you see available. Those are the basic forms that broadband comes in. But fiber is right now today has much greater bandwidth. There are a number of communities that have done that.
Mr. Chair,
I should stop for questions any time you like.
To that point, which name some of those towns, will you?
Oh, there are Brainerd, Bemidji, Grand Rapids, Windham. Those communities all have fiber to the home. There's some around adjacent to those, Cohasset, and Morris. All those communities have fiber to every home in their community, or in the process of installing it. And you can't get it anywhere in the metro area. If you look to all of those projects, in some shape or form, have a public subsidy. Sometimes it's a low-interest loan from the Rural Utility Service, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In some cases, a municipality that has financed it with local financing. But those are the types of projects we're seeing. Now, nationally, Verizon has announced a major fiber-to-the-home, fiber-to-the-premise initiative. AT&T is working on that, but Quest has not. Up to this date, Quest has not announced any major fiber initiatives, and we don't know when that would be occurring. But where you see in outside the metro area, you do see a number of fiber deployments. And we want to look for ways that we can encourage that anywhere. I don't mean to single out Quest, but we need to look for ways to encourage that if we're going to compete globally. So the other thing I want to make some comments about is we're seeing a new business model emerge in these deployments, and it's we've seen it first in Europe, and it's now coming to the U.S. And I want to draw to your attention because you will be hearing more about it, because I know that there are some projects underway right now that are kind of incubating, and you'll probably hear more about that. And that's the open network concept. This is a new business model, as I said, and it's new to this country, but it's showing some really good promise. And it's just one of those things. You know, there are a lot of different ways to skin this cat, and we don't want to say anyone's better than the other. We're intrigued by this model because it creates a new opportunity for public investment. And this open network model is when the infrastructure, the pipes or the cables or whatever brings the broadband to the premise, is owned by the public sector, just like the roads or airports or other types of public infrastructure. But private companies provide us all the services. So the public sector doesn't provide the service. They provide the basic infrastructure, and then different private companies compete. They basically lease space or license space on that infrastructure to provide the service. So the businesses, the schools, the hospitals decide which service provider they want in a competitive environment. This is an intriguing model, and we've seen it in Europe. It's actually in place now in Europe, and it's shown great promise. The other place we've seen it is in Utah, and there are a dozen communities in Utah that have finance the infrastructure, and now private companies are competing on that network. So we're intrigued by the model. We think it's something that communities ought to look at along with some of the other opportunities. The basic thing we know is that to get to the world-class type of broadband, it's going to require the public and private sectors working together. It's too big an investment for the private sector to make alone. It's not all that profitable, so it's not a great attractive investment, but we know that it's essential to economic growth, and we've now seen studies that broadband's been out long enough that we can see studies. Carnegie Mellon and Harvard did a study about a year ago. For the first time, we can see documented what we know intuitively is that communities that have broadband grow faster than ones that don't. That's the basic fact. And so we know we need to encourage this and look for ways to do it. And so there are a number of different models. You will probably see some of these coming your way. I know on the Iron Range right now, they're studying putting in a fiber to the home in about a dozen communities up there. The project is under study right now, and the foundation is looking at that one as well. but it's happening in other areas, and there are different approaches. But you know, I think if you go forward, I just think it's helpful to know what these different models are and what can you do. I would, you know, these are a couple of things that I think would be really helpful in this area. Look for ways to encourage investment. I don't know if that may be the state putting in money themselves, but there are other regulatory things you can do, and I would just look to see how you could encourage investment. You want to encourage creativity and flexibility. There's not one way to do this, but, you know, if people come to you with ideas that will restrict creativity or flexibility, that could be problematic. We need to come up with new ways to skin this cat, or we're, quite frankly, going to be left behind in our global competition. And, again, consider investing along with local communities. There are communities that are saying this is important enough to us that we want to put our tax dollars into this. It's not every place, but there are some communities that are saying that, and I want to encourage you to look to see if you can partner with those, because this is just a major challenge. Those are my comments. I thank you for the opportunity to be here, and I'd be happy to take any questions you have.
Thank you for your testimony this morning, Mr. Fields. And I know we do have a question from Representative Hoppe. Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Fields, you kind of answered this. But going back to you talking about broadband being cheaper in other countries, can you expand a little bit on why that is? Is it because it's subsidized, or is there more competition, or is it a combination?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's actually a number of things, and it varies from country to country. Sometimes it's cheaper because it's subsidized. Sometimes it's cheaper, such as a place like Korea or Singapore, where you have thousands of people living in one building, right. And so it's, you know, the installation is much cheaper. In some cases, it's competition. I think it's really all of those, and it varies from country to country.
One more different question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a thought here, and you might not know the answer to this, but if we're lagging behind parts of Asia and Europe on broadband usage, is there any correlation there, or do the numbers look about the same as to where we are in terms of cell phone subscriptions compared to those countries or those parts of the world?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm sorry, I don't know that much about cell phone coverage. The only thing I will say is that in some Pacific Rim countries, cell phone usage is much, much greater, and there are a lot of activities that people do on cell phones because, particularly Korea and Japan, where people spend a lot of time in public transit, and cell phones are one of the main activities that are used during that time. So there are a lot of cell phone-based programs there that are applications that we don't even see here.
Thank you.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there alternatives to fiber that would get us to the same place in terms of speed and access?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there are, today there are no other technologies that have that virtually unlimited capacity that fiber has. Fiber, they haven't found the upper limit of the capacity of fiber. There are different equipment that you can put in on both ends of it, and that keeps upgrading the speed, but the fiber itself, they haven't found the upper limit of fiber. Right now, the cable companies actually have made some significant improvements in getting higher speed out of cable. With video compression technologies, you're getting more speed out of even the copper lines that come into your home. But as of today, there's nothing that comes even close to fiber. They're looking at, you know, broadband over power lines. That's showing some promise. But again, today there's nothing that really comes close. If I was to rank them, you know, fiber I would put at the top. Coaxial cable is showing the next level, I think, of service that's available. And then wireless is starting to show greater speeds. There's a drop in the reliability of wireless as compared to coaxial cable or fiber. You know, things that weather and other, just like with your cell phone card, you know, it's not always the most reliable thing that you have. And then below that is the DSL service that comes over your copper lines. And so there's kind of a ranking, but fiber is significantly greater.
Representative Thiessen.
And just to follow up on that, and I understand, I guess, the high end or the unlimited capacity for fiber, but in terms of someone's house, you know, the typical residential use. My guess is a typical resident is not going to need unlimited amounts of broadband capacity. For a typical user in their home, would cable, for instance, or some other alternatives be competitive with broadband in terms of what people need, you know, in terms of residential stuff?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a good question, and it actually helps us distinguish between what we're doing today versus what the future brings. Today, if we got unlimited capacity, we wouldn't know what to do with it. A lot of broadband service providers now that provide DSL or cable service provide the bandwidth that most of us need. We don't even have the applications that would use this higher speed. In other countries, they have the higher speed, and those applications are emerging. Okay, but let me talk about some of the things that you can do. And actually, in here, on page three. It lists some of the things you can do, and some of the existing providers will say, well, you can do that today with what you have. The reality is, you can, but it doesn't do it very well, and it does it so poorly that you don't bother to do it. But some of the things that you would be able to do with this higher speed broadband would include things like having high definition video with your doctor and a specialist in another area, the multi-party conversation, a multi-party high-definition video is a service that is coming. It's already available in other countries, but you can't do that today. What we did with the governor with a small webcam was kind of nice, but you could do it with multiple parties in a high-quality way. Vendors talking to their customers in different parts of the world, multiple parties at the same time. Classrooms where you've got group discussions, again, multiple parties together at the same time, producing high-volume video or content from a home office that you're sending out. You would need something higher capacity. So a lot of these applications are not available in the U.S. because there's no way people don't know to use it, they don't know it's available, and so, you know, there's no reason for anybody to develop that when there's no way to deliver it.
Thank you. Representative Morrow, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fields, you may be able to help me out, but I am asking about a specific town, St. Peter. After the 1998 tornado, my recollection is that St. Peter did put in an open network of fiber throughout the town, and I was wondering, A, if you're familiar with the St. Peter example.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morrow, actually I'm very familiar with it because in our community guide to broadband development, we have some case studies, and St. Peter is actually one of them. It's a very great partnership because the city in its wisdom, when they had to dig up the streets and put in some conduit, they put in fiber and then asked for partners, and Hickory Tech was a partner in providing service. So they're a retail provider. Actually, the city put in a fiber loop, and then the coaxial cable goes out. So it's not fiber all the way to the home, but it's a fiber loop, and then the coaxial cable builds off of that. And that's a great example of a partnership where public and private sectors working together to make something good happen. Another good example is in Brainerd, where the school district was going to do a major school expansion, connect up their schools with fiber optic cable. Instead of them building their own network, and this is a frequent problem, which is somebody will come up with their own network, connect their buildings, and there's no additional benefit of that. The schools partnered with the local telephone cooperative and put that money into that project, and then there was enough money to build out the entire city because the co-op could put in some money, could get and the city, and they pulled that together, and now everybody in Brainerd has fiber to their home.
And Representative Junkie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to your page three examples, you list a paramedic arriving at a medical emergency with medical history at their hands, a firefighter arriving at a burning building with the screen having the layout of the building. Those are wireless technologies if you're in an ambulance or a fire truck and it's coming over. So are you alluding that, and this is always been one of my concerns, is we're talking about now building out fiber, and you said wireless was down maybe to step three right now, but improving, you know, in 5 to 7 or 10 years, does wireless then get up to that point or beyond? What are we seeing in the future? And isn't there a danger in just focusing on one technology, fiber? Because you're actually alluding to that in your list here, that the wireless will have the same type of speed as what you're talking about with the hard fiber going into the ground, and as we take 5 years, 10 years to build out some of these cities, are we then obsolete by the time we go in the ground?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Duffy, very good point. These technologies all work together, and obviously with a fiber optic cable, you have no mobility. It's in the ground. It can go with a truck or an emergency vehicle. Wireless today provides service in some very important niches, and mobility is the big one, because if a mobile vehicle needs to have access to the data that it needs to provide better service, but they work together, because with a wireless technology, that ultimately has to connect up somewhere with a backbone to the Internet. It's not wireless all the way. It might be wireless to a tower, and that tower is connected to fiber, and that might go to a national database. Say a police officer stopping a vehicle and needing to do an ID search, it might go into a national database via fiber, but the local connection to that vehicle is wireless. There are a number of important niches for wireless that will never go away. Mobility. Wireless today is the cheapest way to deploy service, and I don't want to discount that. It's not the highest bandwidth, the highest speed, but if you're looking to serve a population that, and it's a narrow slice, it's people who have a computer in their home. They can afford a computer, but they can't afford, you know, the $40 a month maybe, or $30 to $40 or $50 a month for a higher speed service. Wireless is a cheaper alternative. Today is not fast, so wireless will never go away. It provides some very important niches, obviously in parks and other places, you know, coffee shops. There's some access issues you can get to with wireless. So I don't want to discount wireless, but today, in terms of my comments, were mainly about the upper limit on the speed. Today, and I can only speak today, fiber is the fastest. There are important applications, I think, for all the technologies, and that's why, we need to always keep looking at them. If I was to make an investment today in a fixed ground-based system that has the greatest capacity, would be fiber. But that there are certain things you can't do with it.
Thank you, Mr. Fields. And Representative Hoppe, I think, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I have a question and a comment. I don't know about inside layout of houses, but I know in Carver County, the police officers, at least, I would assume fire too, but I know in the police cars, they have pictures that will come up when they go to, if they come to a police call at my house, which they don't, but should they ever have a police call, it would show up on a screen in their car, a picture of the house, so that when they're driving down the street, they know what the house looks like in case you can't see house numbers or something like that. I don't know if we want them to have a layout of every building, but I guess it would help for commercial things. I have a question either for Mr. Fields or Representative Morrow. And I'm going back to the St. Peter example. I'm wondering, 8 years later, is there competition now? I mean, do people have, is it Hickory Tech the only option for people to get broadband to their house in St. Peter, or are there other companies that came in to feed off of that loop?
Representative Morrow, you want to take a stab?
I'd be happy to, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to, Representative Hobbies, take at least an initial stab at it. There is also a cable company, MediaCom, which has access to that opportunity as well. And my understanding is, and I would defer to Mr. Fields, is that there's plenty of room within that fiber loop for other companies to come in as well.
Mr. Fields, would you like to comment to that?
Mr. Chairman, I know at the time that it was built out, the city did a request for proposals and who wanted to partner, and I think Hickory Tech might have been the only partner at that time. Since then, I'm not sure if there have been other companies that have been added to that infrastructure or not. I'm not familiar with that.
Very good. Representative Thiessen?
Just one more quick question, Mr. Chair. In the communities that have put in this broadband loop or that we have fiber to the home, has there been any studies or anything else that talks about whether it's attracted economic development, whether there's been any correlation there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we haven't seen take rate studies on the communities that have put in fiber in Minnesota. The main study that we refer to now, the most comprehensive, is the one that was done by Harvard and Carnegie Mellon that shows that there was higher growth, higher real estate rates, greater job growth in the communities that have broadband. There's also a study of two communities in Iowa, comparing them, that showed greater economic benefits. But we haven't seen any economic studies of those Minnesota communities. And quite frankly, it's a little difficult right now just because they're fairly recent deployments, and you know, it usually takes a little while for that economic benefit to show up in data. But it won't surprise me if a few years from now we see those studies and we can quantify the benefit a little better.
Thank you very much for your thought-provoking testimony there, Mr. Fields. I know next week we're going to be looking further members into the issue of municipalities, so that'll give us another opportunity to kind of examine some of the possibilities in that regard. But thank you again for your testimony. I know we have a time frame we're trying to work with as best we can, and want to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to address the committee. Thank you very much. And coming down next, we have before us Keith Weigel from AARP. Would you like to identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony, please?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Keith Weigel. I'm the Advocacy Director with AARP Minnesota. And I just wanted to give you a very brief comments on our organization and one piece of legislation that will be coming before your division. AARP Minnesota, we're a membership organization of people 50 and over. We have almost 670,000 members here in the state of Minnesota, and approximately around 38 million nationally. And to let you know, our Minnesota State office is simply an office of the national AARP. We're not 50 separate organizations. We are part of the national. Saying that, however, we do have state leadership. We have an executive council. Former Attorney General Skip Humphrey is our state president. And so we have parameters that we're able to work on state issues. AARP as an organization back in about 2000 decided that the work that state capitals provided, that they needed to have a stronger presence. And so they went from having five regional offices and approximately five or six large state offices to within about a 2.5 year period of now having a state office in all 50 states, Washington, D.C., the Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico. And typically in your relationship here and on future testimony, you will typically see a volunteer. Our volunteers are a critical part of our structure, and we're fortunate to have a number of active ones across the state. We do have like 22 or 23 communities where we have local chapters. I know Wilmer and Richfield are a couple that come to mind, but very grassroots oriented. The other thing I would like to say is that our national organization with headquarters, we do have expertise out there on a number of issues where we can be a resource for you to find information, what other states are doing. And I'm not that expert, but I can certainly put you in contact with them. And I believe in your packets there's a two-page key elements for informed choice and consumer protection in the wireless telecommunications marketplace. We did that because that is the bill that we will be working on this session. We'll try to be in touch to follow up with Representative Hoppe and Representative Saylor, because we are looking at finding bipartisan authors on a very comprehensive state wireless protection. We have a model bill See, if you want information, we have plenty of it, but I think the two-pager is better. But I would also offer, knowing that there are a number of people that have concerns or interest on wireless cell phone information, so you could not only use this as perhaps an outline of what we'll be proposing, but as a menu if, in fact, you have a particular interest in one or two of these specific issues, we'd be glad to talk to you.
And just for information, Mr. Weigel, I don't think we received the information that you alluded to in our packet, so you might want to either drop that off at our office,
okay,
or do you have it with you, pass it out yet today?
I was thinking I handed it out yesterday, but okay, we'll get it to you. It's a nice two-pager. That's all I have. We'll hope to see you in the future. Any questions?
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Next coming up is Mr. Ron Elwood, Legal Service Advocacy Project. You want to identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ron Elwood. Represent Legal Services Advocacy Project, which is the group that's up here representing legal aid. And for those of you who might not be familiar with legal aid, we provide legal representation for low-income customers, consumers statewide. And just to give you a sense, last year we served about 35,000 low-income citizens with their legal problems. We also, according to last census, there's about 450,000 Minnesotans who qualify for some sort of assistance, would be qualified or categorized as low-income. We also represent any senior that comes into our office, regardless of their income. So essentially, we are representing here upwards of about a million Minnesotans. And I know you're really serious about these issues, because otherwise you wouldn't be here at 8 o'clock on Friday morning, so I really appreciate that. I just want to give you a couple of comments and sort of a framework for the way we look at telecommunications issues. And the big picture for us, the way we look at it, is the Federal Telecommunications Act, I think, has created a balkanized system. And what has resulted is each of the different entities in the game, whether it's the cable, the competitive local exchange carriers, the incumbent local exchange carriers, the wireless carriers, all of those folks, they're all operating under a different set of rules. And while you hear a lot of rhetoric about level playing field, everybody says they want a level playing field, my own view is that nobody really wants that, because nobody really wants to give up the advantages they have, and everybody wants the advantages the other guys have, but nobody really wants to start on the same, wants to play on the same playing field. So the recipe, what that creates, is just stasis. This, many of you have been here for many years where bills have come forward that are about this thick to kind of fix the system, and it gets nowhere because everybody's got something to lose and nobody wants to give anything up. So the result is stasis. We have, this system has resulted in tremendous technological advancements. We have great gizmos. You know, I have this great little phone, and it's great if I could figure out how to use it, and if I could actually figure out how my big thumbs could touch these little buttons and not mess it up. But if I could figure that out, it's fantastic. But what also has resulted is tremendous consumer confusion. And I don't know what the price we pay. In many of these circumstances, we have consumer contracts that are very one-sided. They're essentially contracts of adhesion, and they're not very consumer-friendly. So the message that I'd like to leave you with today as you go down the path and explore these issues, which are very complex, very technical, is one that I would like to see the committee and the legislature exercise its broad state power to protect the health and welfare of citizens, to ensure universal access to telecommunications and Internet services, to make sure that rates are kept affordable for low-income and rural customers. And in the case of rural customers, you have almost sometimes a double whammy. If you have a rural customer who's low income, so that creates even greater challenges to affordability. And to provide meaningful consumer protections with respect to advertising and communications of choices to consumers? Because I don't know about you, but I have no idea what my cell phone plan is. And fair terms and conditions of service, because that's been a big problem. I do not think that robust competition is incompatible with a strong consumer protection framework. In fact, I would leave you with this thought, that in my view, the best informed consumer creates the most efficient marketplace. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Any questions from members? Seeing none, we'll move on to our next testifier. Thank you very much. From the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, I do believe.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. And it's is it Michael Nowak?
Yes.
If you want to identify yourself for the record, and we'll move ahead with your testimony.
I certainly will, Mr. Chair. For those of you who know me and for the new members of the committee, I'd like to introduce myself. I am Michael Nowak, and I am the president of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. And the MTA is a trade association comprised of 90-plus incumbent and competitive local telephone companies providing voice, high-speed internet, data, and video services to consumers throughout the state of Minnesota. There are two inter-exchange carriers who are members of our association, three wireless carriers, and 290 manufacturers, consultants, suppliers to the telecommunications industry. Our membership includes privately owned telephone companies. It includes cooperatives. It includes municipals. It includes publicly traded corporations. Quest is not a member of our association. Our association is 98 years old. It was formed in 1909 as the Minnesota Independent Telephone Association. In the 1950s, the name was changed to the Minnesota Telephone Association when Northwestern Bell joined the association. And in 2003, the name was changed to the Minnesota Telecom Alliance to reflect the increasingly competitive nature of the telecommunications industry. And I brought along for you, many of you probably have never seen this map, but what this map shows you is various exchanges where the telephone companies provide local service. And each telephone company is assigned an exchange area. And actually, it was back in the 1960s, so that was a major activity at the Public Utilities Commission at that point in time, was to determine the boundaries of where a telephone company was going to provide telephone service. There was a covenant between a telephone company and the state. And what the covenant was that for you to receive an exchange and to have the boundaries, you had to guarantee that you would provide service to any customer who requested service within that defined area. And that was something that went along with the principle of universal service. And it's really, you know, quite interesting because when you look at the state and who the service providers are. The rural telephone companies provide the service to the majority of the geographic area in the state. And those companies are signified in the color gray here. While the major population centers of the state were served by, they're currently served by Quest. Quest is the major provider of local telephone service in the metropolitan areas. But in the rural areas, the small independent telephone companies are the major service providers in those geographic areas. So I brought this along, we hear about in just these general broad terms about, you know, who the telephone companies are. But, you know, until you see a map like this, it's just something that's a word that's out there. And when you see where the companies actually provide service,
it gives you a little bit better understanding of who these various service providers are. This morning, what I would like to do is just to try to help to give you a historical perspective of the development of the telephone and the telecommunications industry. There are a few ways here that I would like to try to help you to understand a very sophisticated and technologically complex industry that is extremely user-friendly. And it is very easy for somebody to make a telephone call. You pick up a receiver, you punch in 7 digits, 10 digits, 11 digits for a long-distance call, and you can communicate with anybody anywhere around the world. And I do appreciate the comments of Mr. Elwood a little earlier when he talked about, you know, with the new cell phones, it's getting to be a little more complicated to do that. But for the most part, the system is extremely user-friendly. It's very easy for the consumer to use. And, you know, that is a good thing because it is very complicated what is behind that in order to make a telephone call, an internet call go through, or for somebody to be able to use the internet. Those are all very sophisticated and complicated things to do. But I'd like to put this in a perspective for you so that you can understand where we've come from in this particular industry. The telephone was invented in 1876, and I'm sure you've all heard the story of Alexander Graham Bell and how he invented the telephone. And after the telephone was invented, it was a couple of years later when it first came to the state of Minnesota. The first telephone company was the Northwestern Exchange Company in Minneapolis. And it started out with 53 subscribers. A couple of months later, the second telephone company, the Tri-State Phone Company, was formed in St. Paul with 35 customers. And since that time, the industry has grown tremendously to what it is today. And for the first approximately 40 years of the industry, it was wide open competition. It was anybody who wanted to put together a telephone system, they could. And they did. And when you went out to a lot of the rural communities, it's interesting to see who the people were who put together these phone systems. It was generally a doctor and a pharmacist. There are a lot of companies in the state whose history comes from that. And it was the need of the doctor and the pharmacist to communicate with one another. And they would start a phone company. It was a magneto phone. It was the steel wires, and you would crank it, and, you know, they would communicate with each other. And that is, you know, that is how these companies started. Well, about the time when the MTA was formed, which was in 1909, the discussion in the United States was talking about all of these companies that were competing out there and the confusion that was caused by it. And the reason why there was confusion at that time was that the companies were closed systems, which means if you were a customer of the Northwestern Exchange Company, you could only talk to people who were also customers of the Northwestern Exchange Company. You would need to buy service from another telephone company in order to talk to their customers. And so you see these historical photos of all these telephone poles in the cities with these hundreds of wires on them. And that was because it was a closed system. You could only talk to the subscribers who subscribed to your telephone company. Well, in about 1915 is when people decided this was a system that wasn't working for us, and we needed to change that system. And our association was actively involved in the writing of legislation at that time, which in 1915 established telephone company regulation in the state of Minnesota under the Railroads and Warehouse Commission. And if you look at the statute, which is Chapter 237, you can go down at the bottom of the page and you'll look at the various citations that are there. And a lot of them will say 1915. So there are a number of the laws that go back that far and establish the regulation of the telephone industry. And so what happened in 1915 was that we changed from a competitive model of regulation to classifying telephone companies as natural monopolies. And that concept of natural monopoly lasted through the 1982, because in 1982 is when the AT&T divestiture took place. During the late 1960s and 1970s was when you had the first talk of reintroducing competition in the telecommunications industry. And that started with basically MCI. MCI wanted to provide long-distance service. And eventually, MCI was authorized by the Federal Communications Commission to be a long-distance carrier in competition with the Bell companies. The Bell companies controlled all of the long-distance lines. And so it was at about that time that you saw that take place. And then in 1982 is when there was the AT&T divestiture. And with the AT&T divestiture, it completely changed the telephone industry. The Bell companies were given local telephone service, and they could provide long-distance service in a limited geographic area, in what was called a LATA. And AT&T was given the long-distance business, the interstate long-distance business, and all of the new technologies that came around at that time. So the computer. The computer was something that was given to AT&T in that deal. And so then for the next up to 96. 1996 was another year of significant change in the telecommunications industry. In 1996 was the passage of the Telecom Act. And in the Telecom Act, it provided for local competition. And with local competition, the competitive local exchange carriers were created. And it allowed for those companies to provide voice service in competition with an incumbent local telephone company. And that is where we are today with that. And so today we have a telecom policy principle of competition, that this is a competitive marketplace and the competitors will be allowed to provide service in the way that they feel is appropriate and that they believe that the market dictates. But you do have some legacies of regulation that are still in the telephone business. And those are the issues that we struggle with today. And that is, what is the balance between competition and regulation? And you've got Chapter 237. There are the rules of the Public Utilities Commission, which begin with Chapter 78-10, if I'm correct in that. And those are the laws and the rules that the telephone companies have to do business by. So that's where that's on a legal and a regulatory basis, the development of this particular industry. When you look at the technology of this industry, there's basically three technological changes that have taken place within this industry. The first has to deal with switching. Switching is basically a piece of equipment that takes your call and then switches it to somebody else. And that's what, and that is what the switch is. There were mechanical switches that were invented back in 1876. And then post-World II is when we moved into the analog age. And the analog age was an automatic switch. You didn't have to talk to an operator anymore to have your call put through. There was an analog switch that did that. And then in the early 1980s is when we moved into digital switching. And the digital switching, and that is the packetizing of a voice message or a data message or a video message, that is what allows us to do all the gee whiz things that we are able to do today, is because of digital technology. And then as far as the lines are concerned, in 1876 there were steel wires. And you remember seeing telephone poles, or if you don't remember seeing telephone poles, you've seen them in pictures where there was a pole, there were two wires that were strung on them, and there was a glass insulator that would connect those, that would connect the wires to the pole. And that was the and that's what was the medium that used to carry the calls. And then secondly, after post-World War II, we moved into the copper technology. And the copper technology was something that could be put underground, and that was a great thing for here in the state of Minnesota. You know, recently you have heard about, like, all the ice storms in the southern part of the United States. Well, we used to have those kinds of problems here in the state of Minnesota, too, with our telephone system. In November, when the ice storms would come through, the telephone lines would fall down, and people would be without service for days. But what we did was to put those lines underground, and so now it's not very uncommon, let's say during the wintertime, if there's some type of storm, your power goes out, but your telephone still works. That is, unless you've got a cordless phone, which needs power to operate on. But, you know, if you still have a telephone that is hardwired to the wall, if there is a storm, you don't have power, you have the dependability of being able to use your telephone. And I think, you know, that is a good thing. And then in the 1990s is when the fiber optics technology came into being. And you use those fiber optic lines every single day. You don't know it, but you use them. The fiber optic lines, I would say probably about 100% of the intercity communications that are carried over the telecommunications network go over fiber optics. And within the local loop, telephone companies have put fiber out to what are known as nodes. And nodes are these cabinets that are in the neighborhoods that distribute lines to people's homes. And so there is a lot of fiber optics that is currently being used in the telecommunications system. You know, it is not to the extent of fiber to the home, which Mr. Fields was talking about, but there is a tremendous amount of fiber that is already in place within the telecommunications network. And, you know, something else that a lot of people don't realize is that with cell phones, most people think, and I thought too, it's that, you know, if you have a cell phone, your entire call is in the air. And that's not correct. What happens is that with a cell phone, your voice communications goes from the phone to a tower. And at the tower is where that call then is transmitted to the landline network and goes through a switching system, goes back out on a landline to another tower to where the call is terminated. And so the landline industry and the landline system is very important to the operation of our wireless communication systems. that are out there. And it's a point that I like to make because I think a lot of people think that with wireless, everything is in the air, and there's a good portion that's in the air, but there's a whole lot more that takes place underground. And then the other most significant development in the telecommunications industry is the development of wireless communication systems. And that was in the early 1980s when the wireless companies were formed. And the MTA was very active in that, and we had a cellular committee. And the people from the various telephone companies from around the state came to a meeting that we had. And we had heard about this new technology called cellular. And the companies were asking themselves, well, is this a line of business that we should be getting into? And we sat there in that conference room, and people could count on their hands the number of wireless customers they had. There was a technology called IMTS before then that provided for wireless communication services. And people could count on their hands the number of wireless customers that they had. And the other piece of information that we had was that, well, AT&T wasn't going to get into this business because they didn't think it was big enough for them. So they weren't going to get into it. But what happened was, you know, our member companies made these applications for the wireless license, for the cellular licenses with the FCC, and they received some of those licenses, and then they started their wireless companies. Rural Cellular Corporation out of Alexandria was one of them. Midwest Wireless out of Mankato, which has now been sold to Altel, was another. And St. Cloud Wireless Systems, which operated under the Cellular 2000 brand name, were companies that were formed by our members when they could get into the wireless business. And today, so when you look at the wireless business, there are now more cell phones than there are wireline customers. So in a short period of 20 to 25 years, you have more people who have wireless phones than what you have having landline phones. So that has been a tremendous change. And all of this, you know, has developed in the last few years under a policy by the Federal Communications Commission, is that competition is what should be driving the development of the telecommunications industry in the state of Minnesota as well as within the United States. And, you know, those are the laws that you're given. That's the situation that we have to work with.
Kind of pace yourself. There about 7-8 minutes. We can work under that time frame.
Yeah, no, I'm almost done okay. with my presentation here, Mr. Chairman. What I see for this industry in the near future are a couple of things. One is there will continue to be a convergence of technologies and services. I see things a little bit differently than Mr. Fields does. And how I see this is in the interaction that our association has with the various manufacturers and suppliers and developers of telecommunications equipment. And those folks are going down a path right now of what is called IMS, which is Internet Protocol Multimedia Subsystem. So what in the world does that particular acronym IMS stand for, or what does it mean? What the manufacturers see for the future of our industry is the ability for voice, data, video services to be used in any type of combination or form and to be transmitted between the different types of service platforms, which would be a wireline platform or a wireless platform. And so the system that is out there everybody is connected and they're able to use all of those different types of platforms with one particular type of communications. And so that is what the manufacturers are seeing for the future. They think that that is the direction that the consumers are going in, and that's the direction that the marketplace is going in, and those are the types of products that they are developing for the future of this particular industry. Well, Mr. Chairman, those are the comments that I wanted to make this morning, was to just to introduce the new members of the committee to the MTA, to let you know that we are an organization that has been around for nearly 100 years. In 2 years, we will be celebrating our centennial, and that we have been one of the partners that has been around for this amount of time to see and work with the legislature in the development of this particular industry. So thank you for the time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Norp, for the history and the information provided. Very, very useful. Are there any questions from members? Brief questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
And we'll move on to our last testifier from the Communications Workers of America. Tim, if you want to identify yourself for the record. And
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for this opportunity. My name is Tim Levison. I am with the Communication Workers of America. I'm currently the president of the CWA Minnesota State Council. And this has been fun listening to all the different testimonies and the different history lessons. Just to give you a little background on the CWA State Council, we are made up of roughly around 8,000 members. The great bulk of those members are people that work in the telephone industry. They work for Quest, they work for Frontier, they work for Garden Valley, and they work for Paul Bunyan Telephone. And each one of those companies are probably treated a little different by this body, the PUC, Department of Commerce, and FCC, depending on how big they are and what regulations they fell under from all the history lessons that you've heard here today. Our major concern is this, is that our members are able to work and continue to work in an industry that they are currently employed in. We are always very concerned with a lot of the rules and regulations that come down. You heard that in 1934, 1915 here in the state, 1934 in the nation, we had a telephone act that basically had regulated monopolies. I started working for Northwestern Bell in 1968. That was during the regulated time. I can tell you that we probably gave the greatest service to the people that they've ever seen. Anybody that has came after the 1984 was when we divested from the old Northwestern Bell and ended up becoming U.S. West. And from that point, I believe customer service that the people knew at the time before that went down. You called the telephone company. When I started with the telephone company, we came out, we fixed everything. You didn't have to call your vendor, you didn't have to call your long distance carrier, you didn't have to call anybody but the telephone company. And we took care of everything. That is one of the things that I believe was really lost in all this competition that has come down. Now that we are in this area of competition, it's kind of like, okay, let's open it up. Let's really open it up. And you've heard all the different ways that all the industries are going together. You've heard bundling. And you're going to hear a lot of, you know, the telephone companies getting into video. Cable companies don't think they should have the same latitude that they have. And all these things, and they're all arguing. I've heard it now since divestiture. And the major concern for us as workers is, hey, We just want to make sure that whatever company we work for, we could still do the work. And a lot of times we see these regulations hamstringing our companies that we work for in different areas. Now, some of the companies, the smaller companies, like Paul Bunyan and Garden Valley, are some of the companies that Mr. Fields was talking about that they have fiber to the home. They're able to get the government loans, the farm loans, and that help that. Plus, they pretty much don't have any competition in their area. Our larger companies that we represent, Frontier and Quest, do have competition. Why? Because just as Mr. Fields stated, in Korea, where they have a building where they can serve, say, 10,000 people maybe, or 1,000 at least, that's where they want to go, because that's where the money is. Well, Frontier and Quest have the larger areas where there's the most people. That's where the competition is. And that's where you see the cable companies offering a lot of the services now with Comcast taking over Time Warner. So that's where the competition is going to be. And if you hamstring one of the players and let the other player do whatever they want, you're not going to get competition in the end. They had that act in 1934. They went to the regulated monopoly. In the early 80s, 82, 83, 84, right in that area, when they opened it up, they let everybody in. And now, in 96, with the latest one, I think they're trying to open it up more, but in reality, if you look what's happening, is they're starting to go back together. And when you think of it, one of the things Mr. Fields said is that they want to have one conduit, basically. That's where it makes money. And then maybe you have people buy onto the conduit. Now, that works sort of, and sometimes it doesn't, depending on how you're looking at it. But just look at it this way. This is what's happening in this whole industry. You have a lot of people putting a lot of things in the ground to compete. Now, do you see any municipality out there having two or three water companies or two or three sewer companies? If you had two or three water companies or two or three sewer companies, how much do you think you'd be paying to get water or sewer in that city? Probably a lot more, because you're building more infrastructure, and that's what the 1934 Act was all about. You had all this infrastructure going everywhere. You couldn't, it's very costly. And that's part of the thing that goes on. And that's why change is so, it's fast and it's slow, because it's very costly in this industry to do the things that people seem to want. And it was fun to hear the part about the how it started out on the open wire. I can tell you that probably the last open wire storm that I was on was in 1975. I would say it was the last great storm that we had here in Minnesota, and that was down in the Pipestone area. And after that storm, the last day of that storm, we were plowing in cable. So I've been up on those poles with the glass insulators in the thing. And I started in this industry when the first big innovation that came up was the touch-tone phone. So I've seen a lot in the 37 years that I worked for the company. But just like to end with this, is that CWA is going to be around. We're going to be watching. We're going to be weighing in on these issues as they affect our workers. And like I said, we represent a lot of workers for a lot of different companies in a lot of different areas, but we mainly want to make sure that our whatever happens, it is a level playing field so that our workers can continue to work in the telecommunication industry. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lowison. Any questions, comments from members? Seeing none, we're kind of winding down for today's committee then. As you can tell, it's a very interesting and complex area that we're dealing with, and we're going to continue this educational effort, and we're also going to hear a few bills, but we're going to continue the education aspect of this committee. Next week we're going to be looking more in a focused fashion at municipalities, and I think you'll find that very worthwhile as well. So till then...